On this episode, we talk about audio, we continue the AWS conversation with Steve Mueller, and we get into more of MIPS 2020.
Welcome to the SE Crowd, a solutions engineering podcast discussing technical topics with guests from our technology community. And now, today's trending topics.
As restrictions ease and more people start to resume their new normal, more information about the transmission of COVID-19 becomes available. New guidelines are created and are an ever-moving target as researchers study more and more about the virus. While there are plenty of questions that come from new guidelines, like when can we safely go back to work, there are certain guidelines that are much more definitive. We know that with all germs and viruses, coughing and sneezing aerosolizes the disease and makes it extremely communicable to others. We know that social distancing and PPE offer us the ability to protect ourselves and others from the dangers of transmission. And we know that hand washing is the first line of defense. We are in unexplored territory day to day when it comes to establishing new guidelines for health and safety. For this week's trending topic, we take a look at, or better yet, a listen to, some new use cases for analytics to help us establish these guidelines and to improve existing security. We've mentioned before how technology and analytics can augment your existing installations. Up to this point, though, we've mostly referenced analytics that need visual data and pixels to trigger events. But there's an entire field of analytics that revolve around audio intelligence and creating actionable events off of incoming sounds. Before we dive too deep, let's talk about some properties of sound and why it is unique to security. In its basic form, sound is defined by two main features: amplitude, or how loud something is, and frequency, or how high or low the tone of the sound is. The combination of these two functions, along with our brain's ability to analyze these tones, results in the beauty that is music or the perception of speech. What makes audio and security unique is how we possess something called the startle response. For humans, the startle response is mostly involuntary in reaction to a sudden or sharp noise. In security, this is best recognized as gunshot or glass break events. These events are very discernible to our ears, and also why they were some of the first audio analytics in the marketplace. With all technology, it has evolved over time. Analyzing audio patterns for increased amplitude and specific tonal frequencies brought forth the idea of the scream alert, which was quickly built into audio intercom devices, stanchions, and cameras. This allowed for immediate assistance to people in distress that could only yell for help and not be able to push a button. The audio channel was immediately opened for emergency response teams to be notified and dispatched into parking lots, college campuses, and other unwell-lit areas at night. Today's audio intelligence is processed with machine learning and artificial intelligence, looking at sounds for aggression or specific vocal keywords, creating the ability to dispatch police and security staff to break up any confrontations as they begin. Audio intelligence is currently being used in the healthcare vertical for acoustic monitoring, the ability to listen to patients for signs of labored breathing, troubles sleeping, or other health concerns that can be actionable events to notify staff and nurses. This brings us back to the pandemic and guidelines. Returning to work and life will not be easy for everyone. There will be a fear of infection and for the health and safety of loved ones. The need for social distancing and PPE will need to be loosened in order to feel like things are safer. The only way to accomplish this is to be the wizard behind the curtain for industries and technology to evolve to the point where masks are not needed because technology is working hard behind the scenes. Understand that a future exists where a sound as simple as a cough is analyzed by AI for its amplitude and tonal characteristics, and that actionable data will be derived from it. Data that will make us feel safer and more protected. Just remember, time, patience, and perseverance will pay off. Stay home, stay safe, and hang in there. Technology is on its way.
You're now listening to the Technology Partner Corner.
Welcome back to part two of our interview with Steve Mueller of Hypersive and talking about AWS in the cloud. As you mentioned, gateways, for people who are unfamiliar with it, so can you give us a quick rundown of what your internet gateway and your VPN gateway, what those do and what that is?
Yeah, well, first, they're not mine, they're AWS's. The internet gateway, so in AWS, the core network concept is known as virtual private cloud or VPC. You'll hear it be called VPC all the time. The industry will call this an SDN or software-defined network. I think that term's died. I think that died long ago, and thank God. The reality is you're just going to deal with a network in AWS. And that the VPC, the question is, when you're in that VPC, how do if you're looking to send traffic out to the internet, what people call the default route to the internet, default route to the internet is going to go over what's known as an IGW or an internet gateway. And the IGW is an attachment to the VPC. It's a logical concept. And under the covers, there's an implementation to that. But an IGW or an internet gateway gets you a route to the internet. So if you've got a server, let's just break it down. If you've got XProtect running in AWS and you need that to perform a Windows update against Microsoft's Windows Update servers, it's most likely, if you don't have a managed infrastructure like WSUS or SCCM, is going to go out an internet gateway to the Microsoft servers. That's the IGW. It's a very basic concept. Incidentally, by the way, if I remove the internet gateway from the VPC, I don't give a route to the internet, this becomes what we call air gap. So a traditional air gap scenario in on-premise for security cameras like the security VLAN or camera VLAN, you can air gap an AWS network as well by just removing its internet gateway attachment or not assigning an attachment. The other type of gateway ends up being known as a VGW for short, or virtual private gateway. And this allows for VPN connectivity into a VPC and or Direct Connect, which Direct Connect, by the way, is a service from Amazon that most enterprises do. And it's it allows for circuit integration between an on-premise location and AWS. And that's in the form of either a point-to-point circuit or MPLS. So a gateway in that case allows a route to go over the VPN or Direct Connect transport.
Sorry to jump around for a little bit, but another thing we mentioned in the keynote that had some weight behind it was the AWS Marketplace. So how does the Marketplace function and how does that benefit us and a customer?
Yeah, good question. The Marketplace is the area of AWS where traditional software that can be installed in EC2 is actually packaged by the vendor, the manufacturer, such as Milestone, as an appliance. And so in the specific case of XProtect, what Milestone's product teams in Denmark have done and are doing right now is creating an XProtect install into an image and packaging that image up, much like a virtual machine template, or as Amazon calls them, an Amazon machine image, aka an AMI. And they are going to publish that on Marketplace. And what this allows for the customers to do is, while it's relively trivial, air quotes, to install XProtect in EC2 today and do all the things, Marketplace actually removes even that. And it says, hey, here's the virtual machine template. Tell us these five or six things that you need to configure with. And less than 5 minutes, your instance is up and running. So it really reduces the operational concern and dependency on the knowledge you have to install in EC2.
So if we have a customer who wants to get into video surveillance and is looking at Milestone and they're already an AWS customer, it's pretty easy for them just to spin up a new instance real quick and resize as necessary off of the Marketplace. So with AWS having a lot of services and a lot of ability from it, what stuff's coming in the pipeline that you could tell us or give us a hint on of that's going to be cool in the future?
Yeah, good question. Kevin hints at this in his keynote. He makes mention to how cloud comes on-prem. And this is an interesting place that I think went a lot, but I'm not sure how many people understood this. This is a breadcrumb for future. So one of the questions that gets asked is, if we think long term, if we think 3 years and 5 years, not just in the immediate, we need to move to the cloud, but ask yourself this: what happens? We're in the cloud. The question is, what do you do with on-prem? I've made the statement on stage this week that on-premise stays, that you need to record for that ultimate master copy, right? The one that can't be disputed and is there when the network isn't. But the question is, in 5 years' time, if your customers and your channel have moved to the cloud, what does happen to on-premise hardware? And this, the compelling event around this question becomes, what happens when my lease is up on my hardware, or my hardware is amortized after 3 or 5 years? Do I buy the same hardware? Do I invest in those $135,000 racks? I argue no. And that's not a knock on the manufacturers or OEMs. I argue that the cloud players, AWS, they have on-premise hardware. And in the smallest form, it's called AWS Snowball. And this is a ruggedized 49.7-pound device that has a hypervisor on it and large storage. Like, for example, in its simplest configuration, imagine being able to rent a box from Amazon that they send to you for $50 a day, pay as you go, for what can be as low as $15,000 a year. And it's got 24 vCPU and 32 gig RAM on it. And if you need more, they've got a box that has 52 vCPU and 268 gigs of RAM, with an NVIDIA Tesla V100 if you need it. And so I argue that the question is, where does it go in just a pure infrastructure play is you're going to see the conversation say, yeah, we need on-prem, but why aren't we just using AWS hardware as well? Things like Snowball. Why don't I record there every 14 days or every 30 days and just rotate Snowballs in and out? And the best part about Snowball is that you can make it so that all the recorded data, when you ship it back to AWS, is actually automatically imported into S3. And this changes the game, right? This changes the game. And there are scenarios that Kevin alluded to with Outpost. Outpost is a rack that Amazon can install on-premise. I think this is a very highly specialized environment. We think telco, we think finance, right? Possibly some of the largest, maybe US government operations. But I suspect that customers will, they're not going to see this problem today and they're not going to see it in 18 months. The forward-thinking customers will. But I think in 2 years' time, when people are in the cloud, the question is going to be, what do we do with this hardware? And they're going to be challenged with the question of, do we just get rid of it? But we want to stay on-prem. And I think devices like Snowball or whatever's going to be out at that time make a lot of sense. And I called it the spare tire around the convention with some folks. I'm like, think about this device as your spare tire. It will always provide you a master recording. And it will always bring it back to AWS with an Amazon-backed chain of custody on that device, which is really important when your data is physically in flight on a FedEx or UPS truck. I don't think the conversation is there today, but I think Kevin dropped that breadcrumb. And it's possible you'll see this come up in Dubai.
Very cool. And so you mentioned this Snowball actually lets you do compute on-prem.
Correct.
So I always thought that Snowball was just transporting data up into AWS away from your local on-prem.
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a really good first generation of Snowball in back in 2015. And AWS realized that there was a need for compute at the edge too. So they put a hypervisor in there. And so, like you said, you get 200 terabytes per device in the storage optimized scenario with a hypervisor. And the configuration is dependent upon what you want.
So with cloud being what it is, it's somewhat new and hard to grasp your arms around. What's the best way to talk to some verticals about the cloud and how that can help them?
Well, I think we're beyond. That's a good question. I want to just call this out. I think the industry is beyond how cloud can help them. I think the industry understands in 2020 what cloud is and how it can help them. I think the questions become more about, is the cloud safe? Are there security controls and concerns? You know, why should I move to the cloud? You know, the reality is this. The cloud, AWS in particular, let's be very specific here. The reason more archive is important to the cloud, that reduces some operational stuff, but the strategic element, if you don't do anything else, being AppStream. The reality is your network is air-gapped on-prem. Most security networks are air-gapped. It means they have no route to the internet. It's very difficult to get on those networks. That means you have to ultimately bring a laptop and plug it into a switch or a router that has access to this network. And so that while it's great for the on-premise guards and security forces there, it's difficult if you have a remote team. So this oftentimes means there's a 24-hour coverage, like, you know, take a casino, take an airport, right? If these systems aren't remotely, if you can't access them remotely, you have to have staff 24 hours a day on-prem to view this. And as much as nobody wants to do this, it's kind of an accepted rule in security that, oh, for all things security, this is important and we must do this. And so they get the headcount to do it, right? It's a huge operational burn. The question is, what if you had a follow the sun model where folks in London picked up where New York left off and then Singapore picks up where London leaves off and then you go around the globe 24 hours a day? Things like AppStream, be very clear about this, AppStream gives you a managed bastion entry point into an otherwise air-gapped network, right? And now you can allow your forces around the globe to view and monitor the systems without requiring a 24-hour dependency in that on-premise camera environment.
You mentioned before chain of custody and some of those things. How does AWS help us with those certifications and requirements?
Well, chain of custody and certifications are two different things, and I'll pick both apart. A chain of custody says I can prove as an entity, if I own a chain of custody, I can prove every step of the way where something is or what happened to that with timestamps and who touched it. Okay. Chain of custody in this discussion with respect to AWS is when we talk about the Snowball device. AWS, you will order a Snowball device. You will, and we're, again, nothing was announced this week at Snowball. This is a future looking thing, but it's where it's going, by the way. Chain of custody says, oh, I'm a customer. I ordered a Snowball device from Amazon. It's in their facility. They're going to put it on the UPS truck and it's going to be delivered. Amazon owns that chain of custody. They can assert, we know where that device is and who's touched it every step of the way. The point at which they transition chain of custody to the end user or the customer is when the customer receives that Snowball. At that point, Amazon no longer has chain of custody. And then chain of custody comes relevant again when the snowball is shipped back to AWS, when the customer puts that snowball on a UPS truck. Amazon then owns the chain of custody. This conversation is very important because you have a company like Amazon who's certifying with a chain of custody that this device is here every step of the way. And this builds customer trust, right? When you have a certifying authority like Amazon saying, we'll give you the chain of custody in the transition. And this is considered customer data. Video data is some of the most sensitive data out there, right? This is what we call, red data. And so it's very important when customer data leaves the hands of a customer and goes into a physical medium for transportation. And that's why Amazon's so strong behind the snowball and chain of custody. From a compliance perspective, this question came up on the trade show floor. Hey, is all of this FedRAMP certified? So when you get into AWS, each service within AWS, be it EC2 or S3 or VPC or Direct Connect, each service has to answer its own. It has to provide its own answers for what U.S. or international or both certifications and compliances it maintains. So some services have like HIPAA, you know, they're HIPAA compliant and they're FedRAMP compliant, and others some may not be. And that's not a deficiency in the platform. It's the services answering to their customer needs for what their certifications need to be. So when the question of certification comes up in the milestone environment in AWS, you have to first say, well, what are the requirements? Is the service or services that XProtect is installed in, are those meeting those requirements for certification? And then you ask, independent of that infrastructure that AWS certifies, if they certify it, is the milestone software certified, right? And so there's no one easy button. You have to look at each component in the mix and say, do we meet the requirements that we have? And these are well published, by the way, on each service page in AWS.
Good stuff. Another question that comes up often, I've heard, is how does Glacier plan and what does Glacier do for archiving long-term video?
Yeah, let's first break down what Glacier is. So if S3 is the large scale cloud storage platform for AWS, Glacier is its sister. And the name is very good. It's a great name and it implies long-term cold storage. And so if you archive out in the work, and just for everybody on the podcast here, you have stuff that's recorded and it's going to live in the recording server on some local storage medium for some period of time until they need to make room for more video. And that gets archived out. And the place you go in AWS is S3. That's the first storage place. And you could be perfectly fine leaving it at S3. And then you're going to pay S3 is considerably cheaper than traditional storage like EBS, Elastic Block Store. But it's also not the cheapest option. Right? The cheapest option, the most affordable option ends up being Glacier. And so tier one would be traditional storage and the recording server on-prem. Tier two would be S3 and tier three in the storage model would be Glacier. And so from a cold storage perspective, Glacier gets you down to fractions of S3 in pricing. Glacier is really good when, as a service independent of Milestone, Glacier is great when you really just need to put something in cold storage to really replace tapes or Iron Mountain. And it comes at a really affordable price. I mean, fractions of a price of S3. The challenge to Glacier, though, is that you pay for it on the retrieval. And so you have to make sure your business case makes sense. Glacier is priced in two ways. One, what size of data do you need to bring out? And two, how fast do you need to bring it out? And so they'll schedule you in for retrieval. Sometimes it could take you 5 hours to retrieve from Glacier, what would be instantaneous in S3. Sometimes it can take a couple days. And the key is the lowest price to retrieval is the one that has the longest time and the lowest amount of data. And so in the video world, you want to be very careful. I really want to hammer this home. Do not lead with a Glacier story. Be very specific about what the story is. You need to make sure that, so for example, video that's 3, 4, 5 years old, right? Yeah, maybe we want to pull that back and look at an incident, and that could cost you considerable in Glacier. But Glacier may make sense if you realize that the jurisdiction in the courts for that video, hey, it's outside of the window, like we've expired that period of time. We just keep this in case somebody makes a claim. But realistically, you know, nobody can make a claim 7 or 8 years after an incident has occurred, right? The relevance is gone. So you have to look at the legal in why you're storing it cold and can you store it cold? And so Glacier may make sense in some scenarios. I just would also add this too. The entire life cycle of moving an object from, you can transition data from the on-prem recorders or the AWS recorders into S3. And then you can even set up lifecycle policies in S3 to say, hey, move my objects, move my data to Glacier in these conditions over this period of time. So you can say, hey, 1 year out, 2 years out, 3 years out, just automatically do it for me behind the scenes. It's like setting a timer, right? But I will encourage everyone in this podcast, Glacier is a great name. It's a great message for the industry to have cold storage, but it does come at a price and it can be pretty punishing if you have to go to it. And the expectation in playback, by the way, is all the data right now. And so that can be very expensive. And that will lead to a very negative experience for your customers, where I've seen bills get upwards of, more one comma, right, with five digits on that pullback. So let's be realistic about what this is.
Yeah. Glacier can be a surprise if you're not ready for it.
Yes.
Another thing we haven't really touched on, can you tell us about the durability of storage and AWS in general?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's durability, and then there's an availability concept. And so when you deal with AWS, the first thing, I'm going to answer your durability question a different way. So the first thing you deal with any AWS service is what's the availability? And that doesn't mean the uptime of, it doesn't necessarily mean the uptime of the service. It could. It's service dependent. The availability, first and foremost, is can I manage that service? And so underneath the covers, can I make an API call to the web service to start or stop a server or retrieve my data? Right. Fundamentally, everything in Amazon Web Services is web services driven, and therefore there's an API. That's an availability factor. Then the availability in something like EC2 is not only can I control my server instances, start and stop them, reboot them, you know, whatever I need to do to manage them, but is it actually up and running in what we would call the data plane? Are those machines actually running, right? Is it up? The durability factor you're talking about comes with storage. And so durability in S3, it's well documented. I won't comment on to what that number is, because if you go to aws.amazon.com/S3, you can find all of the relevant areas around the durability, but they do give a number in S3, a percentage as to what that durability is. And I would say that the durability focus and how Amazon gets to durability with S3 is that it is a service whose data is replicated across the what's known as the availability zones within a region. And S3 is designed to be highly durable. We're talking like beyond five nines. I think the actual number is 12 nines. But the authoritative is going to be aws.amazon.com/S3.
So now with video living out in the cloud, what does that mean for us? What's exciting about that?
That's a good question. So without speaking to some of the knowledge I have on your internal plans, I'm not the person to do that. But I think if you ask yourself this question, like, okay, we move the infrastructure to AWS and yeah, we have on-prem and yeah, we solve the business problem of surveillance and reporting and archival and all the things that everybody in your company gets paid to do every day. It's like, what are we really doing here? Right. And you have more or less infinite network compute and storage in AWS. And it's more than just virtual machines. AWS has a tremendous investment in machine learning and machine learning models. SageMaker, for example, is a great service to look at. They're doubling down on neural networks and artificial intelligence and now quantum mechanics, right? Quantum computing, I should say, not quantum mechanics. And they're also really invested in analytics, right? Which I guess is an amalgamation of these kind of things. But imagine a world in the future where if the video is already in the cloud, what does that mean for milestone research and development engineers? What does that mean for the teams in Denmark and Barcelona and Sofia, Bulgaria? What smart things can they do with video in a way that you can't do today because you're limited on the on-premise world, right? And I think that's the most interesting thing about this move. I think the industry will eventually shift there in 3 to 5 years. That's my guess. That's my forecast. And they can leave it as business as usual. But I think the really interesting thing inside Denmark and inside Milestone as a whole is this idea of we can do really intelligent things now with video other than store and ship. What if we actually analyze video? What if we do this in a way where we couldn't before because we were so constrained with the local hardware? And the inconsistency of that hardware and the inconsistency of the software, right? And I think that's what this opens up. And there's nothing there today to talk about. Barry Norton, actually, Dr. Barry Norton from the R&D team did a presentation, a keynote, his own message following our keynote. I'd encourage everybody to watch that. And I will argue a lot of that's going to be over people's heads, not because you can't understand it, but because he's very out there. He's thinking 5 to 7 years. But if you want to get a sense of where this is going to go, this is it, right? And so the question I think every Milestone employee should ask is, we might be a physical security technology company today, but what if we're a video expert company in the future, right? What if we break the shackles of traditional physical security and go into video and video analysis and video reactions, right? And you're building, you could be building, you know, it's possible that you could be building your next generation, you know, analysis company. And so you get into domains that are far greater than just access control and surveillance. And I think that's the most exciting thing here.
Yeah, sounds great. Sounds like the future's gonna be a fun place.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Well, I thank you again for your time. Again, this was Steve with Hypersif. It was helping us talk about AWS and how it relates to Milestone.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And now let's join the engineering roundtable.
Welcome back, guys. We are here still at MIPS 2020. We're continuing the conversation that we were just talking about, and we're going to get right back into it.
AWS, the setup itself didn't seem to be too bad. It's just click go. It makes a Windows instance, and you do have to know a little networking to say, okay, yeah, this is where I want my network to point to, or the IP range, or that kind of stuff. But you need that anyway if you're setting up a server. So I don't think the skill set's that much vastly different.
Well, it's going to be
one versus the other.
I think it's going to be the same battle we've always had. And that's if it's an IT group doing it, they're going to be great. If it's a security group trying to learn AWS, it's going to be a battle for us.
They'll need some handholding.
Well, and if it is that type of organization that doesn't have a solid IT, because sometimes that is why they go towards a cloud solution, you know, because they don't really have an extensive personnel. One, they're typically used to doing at least some sort of management of the cloud. And two, you know, we're going to want to point them to an integrator that, and I'm not exactly sure how this program is going to, you know, be rolled out, but Kevin Marrier says on the stage that we are actually going to be rolling out a certification for this. Right. So I would assume to be able to deploy this into the marketplace, a certificate would be a prerequisite. I'm not sure if that's something you can roll into on Amazon to prevent that, or maybe we're going to be putting a special license. Doesn't sound like we're doing that, but.
Yeah, because one of the things that I was really interested in, the one slide that went up, was when, from a sales perspective, when you start looking at who's a customer of what and where opportunities start to exist, you know, we're introducing a buzzword that is going to excite a lot of people, but some of those people are going to be prepped and ready to go because they're both AWS customers and Milestone customers, and it's just a matter of turning on the switch because now they're linked. Whereas when you're talking true, you know, greenfield, and they're not us and they're not AWS. So that's a really large amount of information.
It's a big learning curve.
Yeah. It's a big learning curve. You know, so
this would be a great place for a pro services commercial.
Yeah. So pro services. There's the commercial.
Where's your sad trumpet button?
Yeah. No.
No. Is your server slow? Call pro services.
The idea that pro services now can get involved and help roll out a deployment for an undereducated dealer is something that this is now, again, more information for us that when are we going to AWS training? You know, that's really, I mean, is it something that should the engineers, should some of the sales team, the inside team? I mean, this is an entire shared partnership now. Where does it start? Where does it end? I mean, we have experts on our team.
Yeah, you would find from training that it focuses so much on the stuff in AWS that we're not using, that so much of the cloud hooks are getting you into their managed services and much less of just lift and shift and forklift your stuff out. I mean, so that's what you really find for a lot of the AWS training is that it's working. As we were talking in the interview, when he's talking your VPCs and some of that networking stuff, right, that would be immensely helpful for our group to go through and see.
Right.
Yeah. To me, the way I view this is we're going to need to be as knowledgeable about that as we need to be as knowledgeable as SQL or as knowledgeable in, you know, setting up a domain. Sure, you know, we can go ahead and get that set up in a basic manner, but you know, I don't know if we need to necessarily be, you know, fully certified. I have an interest in that. I mean, AWS does really seem cool, and when you start to really get into the nitty gritty, you know, there's definitely some things that could be beneficial. But as far as to get our system itself up and running, I think that processing, understanding that would be pretty basic. But the short answer is yes, we do still need to get at least some sort of training. And I think that's why, you know, putting out a sort of certification program for a milestone makes a lot of sense. You know, and it wouldn't make sense for us to just tell all our integrators, go get certified on AWS, because that's a huge ask.
Right. And the biggest thing that came out of the interview and the biggest thing that came out of the rollout is that this has to be tiered. It has to remain on-prem as well as cloud, because there will always be the need to have immediate data. There will always be the need for certain data to be backed up. There is a handshake that gets created between stored video that you want to export and how you actually export it. You know, right now we put it on a USB stick. Well, guess what? That is a cybersecurity flaw. You don't want to do that. When you deal with certain enterprise companies, they don't allow anything plugged into the computers. So how does that data live? Where does that data live? Where does it get transmitted to and stored and things like that? So having some of that data local is important.
The other problem I think we hit with a lot of the AWS stuff is there's a lot of misconceptions of what is AWS versus what's cloud versus what's on-prem versus what's not.
Right.
I mean, because so many times someone says, oh, it's a cloud thing, and they're thinking your Ring doorbell. I mean, they're thinking it's a complete turnkey. You don't do anything. It just magically works. And that's kind of not what we're aiming at right now with AWS. This is more of a, if you had dropped in a new VMware ESXi server, that is more akin to what we're doing with AWS. It's just in someone else's data center. So if we rented a rack and put a server in, it's similar to it.
Right. But that brings the one of the questions I had internally for us earlier was there's a price point where the idea of the personal cloud, you know, you go out and you get your Dell EMC and you load up racks of storage, you create your own data center. You're creating your own personal cloud. Enterprises do this day in and day out. Where's the price point? Where's the customer size? Where's the vertical? Where's the conversation need to start and end with who you talk cloud to? Everyone's going to want to talk about the buzzword, but where is the right sale? Where is the right design to actually go and fit it where it belongs instead of shoehorning it into some place that it doesn't?
And as you say, the cost and some of that coming in for what sort of behind the scenes, I mean, they kept touting, oh, no, don't worry about energy costs. That's picked up by Amazon. Amazon's also picking up security guards or guarding the data centers and personnel and staff. I mean, so cloud isn't just a computer in some guy's closet. I mean, it's a real operation. So there's more overhead involved with that. So it's not just exporting or it's not just outsourcing only your hardware itself. You're outsourcing labor and something else. Right. So yeah, a lot of times people jump into cloud and they're like, this is great. We get to it. Oh, it's expensive. Well, you're also replacing people functions with a lot of this. So that gets missed a lot.
And to that, there was also some confusion over the whole BYOL thing.
Yeah.
And I thought Tim was abundantly clear about it, how we were approaching it. But there was a customer that approached me and was wanting me to explain the whole BYOL thing and had to reiterate to him, yes, we're still selling through integrators. Yes, you still have to bring your license. You know.
And the BYOL thing is not strange for that cloud industry. I mean, that's real big on AWS with Oracle specifically. Oracle's licensing is Oracle's licensing. And so it's a whole thing in half. So, I mean, that's where some of it comes from. I mean, even for Microsoft and your Windows licenses, you can do a bring your own license for a Windows instance on AWS.
Sure.
So the whole BYOL license thing is not some new thing that Kevin invented.
It's not Ring, though, where we give them a turnkey solution. You're bringing your own license.
Yeah. It still requires an integrator, a dealer, pro services to really get a lot of that stuff working. This is not click a button, magic, now you can sell it type deal.
I do really see some opportunity, you know, circling back to when we were talking about with professional services. You know, I think the fact that we're trying to definitely scale that out and try to help support the channel, being able to provide professional services and offer maybe even just a management server in the cloud, because that's honestly probably where you get the most, I would say, complexity when it comes to, you know, setting up the milestone system is related to that. And if we could just go ahead and quickly stand that up for them and support everything through that AWS basically interface.
Yeah, AWS Marketplace, I think is what it's called.
Marketplace is more like your app store on your phone where you can go through and install something from it. Management console is what you're talking about it. And no, that would definitely be a spot for a pro service. I mean, have us go in, set up your VPC, that's sort of your virtual data center looking thing and your availability zones. And I mean, that set up all that kind of stuff so that it actually is already built for them. Is that way it's replicating more of the here your environment's built, now put stuff in it.
Yeah. So I think it's pretty exciting. I mean, you know, we're not, from a technical standpoint, we're not doing anything extra really to get this up and running. This is, most of this is something that could have already been done. It's just that the fact that we're moving forward and putting together this as a solution and actually putting some support for the channel for it, I think is what's really the, honestly, the deliverable from this.
You know, yeah. As we say, set up the VPC. One other thing that Kevin was mentioning was they're looking at CloudFormation. And so CloudFormation, if you haven't played with AWS, is a way to define your environment from subnets to virtual switches. I mean, to every single aspect of it in one file. So you can just hit a button and it deploys a solution for you. I mean, you can have a button, you hit it and it puts up 40 management servers and 50 recording servers, and that does some crazy
stuff. That is a project I'd like to have. So yes.
So pilot up, for example.
So the entire idea of the micro pilot, That is a term that will become a very popular one for us.
Sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder.
No, you're fine. It'll become a pretty popular thing because it's the quick instance. It's giving somebody remote access to a spun up AWS instance that allows them to get in and have 30 days with their bells and whistles and their features. Yeah, it's going to be something that'll will definitely change the pilot program.
So while we're talking about AWS, did anybody else find it kind of an oxymoron that they're doing AWS on-prem cloud?
I think the real focus from Amazon and AWS on that is more to get you to migrate over to cloud. Not so much to try and do some hybrid on thing. It's more of a, here, drop this in your data center. We'll start migrating over from it. At some point in time, it is going to come by, pick that thing up with a semi, ship it back to their headquarters, pull your data off, and now you're all the way in the cloud. So I never thought it was a real solution for it. I mean, he mentioned Outpost, and that's like, that's not a, hey, my local K-12 wants to have some on-prem cloud stuff, so let's drop an Outpost rack in. It's more like your JP Morgan Chase is going, I don't know, maybe we can afford this. It's not a small thing.
Gotcha.
So to bring it back to MIPS 2020 and kind of wrap up the show floor concept. I mean, the AWS was a really large component of the last 2 days. It's something really that will be a large component going forward in all of our discussions that we're going to have. I did have some insight as to who the partner of the year is going to be. And it is always one of those booths that has a lot of excitement around it. And I was just curious what other people thought of Live Earth. This show will be broadcast after the awards dinner. What did everyone see?
So I caught the tail end of a demo when we were over there. And the part that I caught was the part that I was already familiar with a bit. But I thought it was an interesting concept because I forget the guy's name, but he was the VP over there that we were talking with. And he was talking about a few case studies that he has where what they're actually doing is bringing in multiple VMSs into Live Earth. And for some of these cities, they're almost using Live Earth as kind of a BSIMP. Yeah. Which is interesting. I mean, it's definitely not a traditional BSIMP, but it is a good interface. It's a great interface to be able to bring those in. So, you know, he was talking about a project where you could have, because they have integrations with our competitors, with Genetec, Exact, Avigilon. And, you know, if you're connecting all these different points of the city, you can go ahead and bring those in into a centralized interface and connect that with all the other great endpoints that Live Earth connects with as well.
Yeah. So I actually had a sit down interview with them, and it'll be on a future show. We talked about a couple things that I didn't even realize that Live Earth did. And one of the big ones is that, you know, you look at it and it's immediately known as the outdoor map. Like, it's the city surveillance, it's large scale deployment, it's tying all these cool, you know, emergency response things and notifications together. But they worked with the NC4S, which is the National Center for Spectator Sports and Safety, which that was formed right around the Super Bowls up in the Meadowlands. And there was a large conference for it. And they do interiors. They do large venue buildings. So they work it in a very similar way to we use smart maps, where you can create the building, You can create the floor. You can add the cameras and the notifications and the events. So it's really complex and dynamic at that point.
Sensors and trackers and all the other stuff that's
in there. Per floor basis. So now you're not just talking large scale deployment or cities. You're talking about, you know, venues that we do play in often.
Yeah, venues, campuses, right. Arenas, stadiums.
Yeah, I had two integrators that brought by and it blew their minds. I take it for granted because I know who they are and I'm familiar with them, right. But there are people that haven't seen it. And I described it as this is the CSI Miami fantasy stuff you see on TV that doesn't exist. Well, this is that thing in real life. It actually works. It's really impressive.
You can zoom in on a reflection in their retina.
One LPR of the reflection of a screw. Yeah.
I do think that a lot of us, probably just general insecurity, but in Milestone, I think we do have a tendency to put partners in a bucket. You know, immediately, you know, there's a couple of partners I talked with and I found out more about it than what I had assumed, like Tiger Technologies. They're one that they had a presentation to the SE team before through, I think it was one of the mats. The Tech Alliance team goes and puts together for us. But they've got their great solution. They've got some further integrations with their cloud integration where they can do an overlay on the playback and stuff like that, which was kind of a highlight for me to be able to see, like, you can see a playback bar, it'll automatically do an overlay in there where it'll put a color depending on where that actual video is located. So if it's something that's located on-prem, you can say, okay, I can do a playback from this and not have to worry about the egress cost. This is a cloud. Or if it is, you know, marked with a certain, I believe it's blue. So like for cold, that means that you have to retrieve it from the cloud. So that's going to cost you. But even when it retrieves it, it actually caches it as well. So if it's something that has been cached recently, then it puts it as a different color. So it's pretty interesting. And they're showing that and they've got a management client plugin for all the settings and configuration for that. So it's a pretty neat integration. And then I walked away and I was talking with some of our integrators and then they were talking about like other solutions that Tiger does because they've got like five other different things that they didn't even, you know, pitch to me while I was over there. And I had to circle back because, you know, I'm dealing with a large scale airport project right now and they've got a great solution for that too. So now we're working with them for that. So, you know, it's easy to like think of these like, okay, Tiger, they're the cloud guys. You know, they were maybe, you know, Brief Camo, they're just, you know, for Synopsis, not necessarily for live, but you know, they're making that transition. Right. So I think there's definitely some value in not, even if there is you know, a booth there, like I've seen that before, there is a value in going back to them and actually seeing what's new. Cause a lot of times, even if it's not new, you're gonna find out things that you didn't know about them.
Yeah, I can add to that too. IO Nodes, they have ruggedized little NVRs for putting in buses and cars and whatever. And it's a pretty slick solution that you can interconnect. And if you have 4G service, then it comes over, you know, I mean, it's kind of what we know them as or for. But they also have a little decoder module. So kind of like we've been using Nooks for smart clients or public view monitors. I also recently played with an Android device. That's pretty slick. It connects back to the mobile server, but they also have their own solution too. And it's, I'd say it's more commercial. So that's another option, is kind of a DVR, but a decoder solution or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's interesting. I definitely get that question a lot about like if we support a decoder.
Right.
It sounds like it's not an actual decoder, but it is a good solution.
Right, for yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
And DLNA is just not a good fit most of the time either because it's hard to get to work.
What is that delay on the device?
Well, and then your TV has to be. I mean, I've tried and tried.
10-second buffer.
And on that note, so actually, we're going to wrap this up. It's been a very good MIPS 2020. I want to thank you guys for joining me here today for this roundtable, and we will see you next show.
That's a wrap on this show. Join us next time when we talk to Seneca in the Partner Corner and we cover body-worn cameras in the roundtable.